We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
You're listening to the ESPN Footy Podcast.
Hello and welcome back to the ESPN Footy Podcast for another week. I'm Jared Barker, still keeping the host seat warm for Maddie Walsh, but Jake Michaels and Champion Data's Christian Jolly is with us as usual. Some big results on the weekend and a big round of footy coming up to look forward to as well. I feel like the season's really starting to ramp up now, and for that we've got a lot of exciting stuff to get to in today's episode, but... Before we do get stuck in, Jake, something you noticed from the weekend of footy.
Well, hello, Jared. Hello, Christian. And hello to Matt, who is not on Australian soil at the moment. So hopefully he's listening and enjoying the show as we kick on without him. Something I noticed, I'm going to go back to Anzac Day. And I feel like generally when I do these, something I notice, I do throw back to the start of the previous round. And the Jamie Elliott mark. So... I don't think anyone
you noticed that mark, did you?
I don't think anyone that watched footy didn't notice that mark. Now we'll talk about that in a second in terms of how good it was and how it compares. But we were talking about this, and there's in all of these great marks, you go back and look at them through history, you can see that for some other weird reason, they always seem to be close to the fence. Yep. So you have the crowd right behind, and there's always one or two people either looking at their phone as he's on his head. Or, you know, walking down the aisles. And in this one, sure enough, there's a gentleman walking down the aisles, just kind of like looking as if, where's my seat? And as Elliot is on top of Mackay taking that hanger. And it's just, you can always say...
The little details that you don't notice.
Well, you can always say, was there. I was 5 metres away from him when he took that mark. But you didn't see it.
Well, you can say I was one of the 90... How many people were there? 95,000 or something. I was the one that didn't see it.
He was there, level one. We were at home watching. We saw it. He didn't watch it, and he was at the ground.
What would you rather? Would you rather be watching it live and see it on TV or be 5 metres away but not looking at him? I don't know. It's funny, but it's the case every single time. And it is... I mean, I would put money on it right now that will not be beaten for Mark of the Year. I think for so many reasons. We know it's become somewhat of a popularity contest with the big clubs, and they don't get bigger than Collingwood. Popular player, Anzac Day as well, which plays into it as well.
Yeah.
The mark itself, I am struggling to think of too many better marks in my time of watching footy. And the other part of it, which is so underrated, was he went back and nailed, and I don't know what the expected score on that kick was, but how often do you see players take a hanger and miss a 25-metre out directly in front?
Oh, it was a ripping kick.
He kicked, it was a perfect drop punt from where he was, and I think all of that, you put that all into one parcel, it's one of the best, forget Anzac Day plays, I think it's one of the best sequences of footy one player has had in terms of just a 30-second, 40-second highlight reel. Fantastic. Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. What do you guys think? Where does it rank?
Mark or a moment?
As a mark, yeah, because you can't really look at it all, but I'm just saying...
It's one of the best of the last decade, at least, when you think back in...
The one that always springs to mind for me is
Walker.
Andrew Walker. Yep. And then going back further to 2001, I think it was Gary Moorcroft.
So there was such Moorcroft, Walker, and Elliot one. Love them all, and probably all up there. And I'm not the greatest memory.
I've got a different favourite,
but I love it when ones where they're sitting on top of a pack. So they were all just one-on-one marks, and they're all great. But there's been some great, and again, this is going back to early 80s. There's a Michael Roach Richmond mark that I used to see as a kid. He beats 10 people, and he's standing on 10 people's heads to take some marks. And
there was in the schoolyard.
Yeah, I think there was a Liam Ryan one. It was on Max Gorn, but there was sort of those three or four other tools there. I think those ones just aesthetically look better when there's a bigger pack underneath the players. But yeah, I can't think of in terms of the crowd, the moment, and the mark for Elliott. Yeah. It's been
Ryan's was really good. That was one I'd forgotten about. Yeah, that was on Gorn.
I think he took two in a row on Gorn in a game, and one of them was just a little bit more of a pack underneath him than usual. Those are the ones that sort of catch my eye a little bit.
I don't know, there's something for me a bit more aesthetically pleasing when it is one-on-one, and I think back to Jeremy Howring, I think it was 2012, when he was a Melbourne player, taking one over Heath Grundy of the Swans. He just sat up on his back.
Yeah,
knees right on the neck, and just sat up there for an eternity. I thought that was just a pure great mark. That's my favourite one that I've seen.
And
in the hands, clean as well.
Agreed. And not to go down too many different directions with this mark, because I know we've got to get back to something you noticed. But I had a look at the winners of Mark of the Year, and since it's become Mark of the Year, I think it was 2001, since it's become an official
award. Well, I just heard this morning, Gary Moorcroft was the last player to receive a car for the Mark of the Year, and that was 2001, so we haven't seen a car.
But we have never had a winner. We've never had a player win the award twice. Jamie Elliott has won it. I think 2013 he took Mark of the Year.
Yep.
This is going to take some beating. As I said before, I don't think it will be beat for a number of reasons. He would be the only player to have won it twice. Now, I think down the line, the goal of the year will be named after Eddie Betts. He's won it four times. How many times do you have to... twice, I don't think, gets you there.
Nah.
Three, I reckon, is probably the minimum for them to name the award after you. But a little quirk that it's no one's... Since it's become that award and it's known as that, because I think previously they used to have Channel 7's Mark of the Year or whatever it was. It wasn't the AFL's Mark of the Year as we know it today.
Yep.
But since then, no one's won it more than once, which is a bit of a quirk. And one other thing I want to say as well is we spoke about expected scores with kicks for goals. Have you guys ever considered doing anything with expected chance of taking a mark?
Not really. Well, it'd be too many. Probably we don't have enough sort of data points together. You need to know, I don't know, where Ben McKay was, where Jamie Elliott started,
factors,
how far away you were from the kick. Yeah, too many things we don't capture.
Yeah, because we were talking about last week what the hardest kicks are and should that determine what's goal of the year. It's like, well...
There was probably one 2 or 3 weeks ago, Carlton, GWS, towards the end of the game, and there's one where Carlton go into the forward line and Harry McKay sort of does a lunge.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, well, it would have been great to know. Was he better off staying upright and just trying to get the ball on the bounce because he was a 0% chance? Or what was that dive worth it? Because it was sort of playing out in my head. It was like, well, when he went to ground, that was it. If he didn't mark it, that was it. But if he didn't dive, the ball might have just kept sailing through and gone out of bounds or something. But
no, maybe something to put on the radar.
No, as I said, we'd have to cover a lot more. We'd have to increase.
Anyway, sorry to hijack that, but I thought it was great. It was great to see.
Yeah.
And as I said, we'll be stunned if anyone tops that this year.
Nah, good chat. Christian, something you noticed.
Yeah, well, I've gone back to Anzac Day as well, hopefully we're not living in the past too much. Well, I did know. Well, one other thing I did notice is the crowds. We have the second biggest crowd across a round ever, and I think it's only second behind round one earlier this year.
Yeah.
But I just noticed, unfortunately, we had a Tassie game in the middle of that, so we had an 88,000 difference.
To footy in Tassie.
There was 5,000 people in Tassie, 93,000 on Anzac Day, so 88,000 difference between the biggest crowd and the smallest crowd. That's the biggest differential we've seen in a round. Records are a bit incomplete pre-1950, but we're pretty sure there wouldn't be a bigger differential in one round. But the other one that sort of, whether it's something I noticed or something that sort of ticked me off, we saw Scott Pendlebury and he reached his magical milestone of 10,000.
10,000.
But can I ask you, what was the 10,000 of?
Well, I think everyone knows it was 10,000 disposals, but I don't think people still know the difference between a disposal and a possession.
Correct, I don't believe they do, because it was also sort of pumped up of... But leading into it was like, is this a bigger record than it should be? Are we not giving enough credit? He's the first player ever to reach 10,000 disposals in a game. He's had, 10,000 disposals being kicks and handballs, what you're trying to do. He gets it. And of course, the commentators start banging on about his 10,000th possession and great on Scott Pendlebury for his 10,000th possession. Unfortunately, that's still 22 possessions away for Scott Pendlebury. So he's at 9,978. So we'll let you know when he gets to his 10,000th possession. But yes, just want to put it out there. It was definitely his 10,000th disposal. It was his 10,000th kick or handball.
Yeah.
It wasn't including his marks or his handball receives, which are possessions and a totally different
thing. This staggers me, in all honesty, that, and look, I'm sure I get plenty of things wrong, but something fundamentally as simple as this, it's astounding to me that every single person talking about football, even my favourite commentators, get this wrong every single week. Well, it's astounding.
Question one on the champion data screening test, if you do send in your resume, is what is the difference between a possession and disposal? So for anyone out there that's looking for work, just learn the answer to that. That'll get you at least, you know, your first foot in the door. It's the very, very first question we ask.
But we see it all the time where a player will take a mark and they'll turn around and they'll be looking for a kick and the commentator will say, he has just had his 20th...
No, they'll say...
Sorry, he's coming up for his 20th possession.
Mm.
It's like, no, the second you have your hands on the ball, you've possessed the ball.
Yes, and quite often they are looking at the D column, which is disposals, to quote us and how many possessions they've had. Yeah. So
you have to possess it to be able to dispose it. I mean, not all the time, but...
Correct, holding the ball.
Those two things happen. Yeah.
Big one is holding the ball. You've possessed the ball, but you get no disposal. Yeah. And the other big one is a kick-in. You don't get a possession, but you'll get the disposal from the behind kick-in.
So if Scott Pendlebury hacked the ball off the deck 10,000 times, he'd be up to 10,000 disposals.
Zero.
And he would have had zero possessions.
Yeah. So, don't think we'll ever be saying that.
I forget your point. Well done. Something I noticed, just a quick one. Elliot Yeo had 19 possessions. Am I getting it right? 18 of those were contested. I just thought that was a really high rate. So 94.7%. of his possessions on the weekend were contested.
Matt Rowley.
Even then, if you're getting 30 and 27 are contested, it's not as high a rate as Elliot Yeo. So we asked Christian just how that ranks in terms of a contested possession rate, and it's up there.
Yeah, so, I mean, with a rate, so the most contested possessions, I think, is about high 20s. So you're not going to see a higher rate, even if you sort of add in two uncontested possessions, because you need to be at 36 contested possessions to two uncontested to reach the same ratio. So, yeah, I just ran every game, and the most contested possessions for players to have one or fewer uncontested possessions. So Nick Natanui, round 19, 2014, had 20 contested possessions, one uncontested. Mm. Hugh Greenwood, another sort of contested ball beast, round 9, 2018, 19 contested possessions, one uncontested. And then Elliot Yeo joins Charlie Dixon from round 4 last year, who they both had 18 contested possessions with one contested uncontested possession. So just sort of ran to see who had the most contested possessions without winning any uncontested possessions. And both Nick Natanui and Robbie Warnock have both done it with 15 contested possessions.
Robbie Warnock.
Zero uncontested. So a lot of ruckman in there.
Yeah, I was going to say.
But again, Elliot Yeo, I think there's a little bit of... I think he's very underrated in terms of what Harley Reid is doing is great, and he's a superstar. I think it's made a little bit easier from the grunt work that Elliot Yeo is doing at that coalface for West Coast.
I certainly didn't think he was, I think it's fair to say, capable of doing this year. I think most people thought he was very, very close to calling time on his career. He suffered a lot of injuries, but what he's been able to do this year has been extraordinary and of a really poor side. Yeah, agree, 100%. You know, I'm surprised Matt Rowell's name doesn't come up on that, because he, to me, is that player that is just so much of it is contest.
I think again, he's lucky to get the three or four handball receives to sort of pad that out. But you look at Matt Rowell and Hugh Greenwood, two of the highest percentage across their careers.
Right, into the main body of the podcast. Well, Jack Higgins copped a three-match ban from the MRO, the Saints, and he will be at the tribunal challenging that tonight. Jake, we've seen a few dangerous tackles or sling tackles over the last few years. A lot of them have actually been let off, but Higgins has copped 3 weeks because of the impact was graded as severe impact. Aaliyah was obviously concussed from this. I mean, where do you see it? Is the 3 weeks fair? Is it excessive? How do you want to unwrap this?
Well, it's excessive, but it's excessive because, once again, we're focusing on the outcome as opposed to the action. I have no issue stamping out the action if we deem this as... a tackle we don't want to see, which I disagree with that, but I can live with it if the AFL says this exact tackle is what we don't want in the game, then punish everyone that does that exact tackle, not just the ones that the player getting tackled ends up concussed. And that's where I get frustrated, because what they say they want to stamp out is the action, and you can't just focus on the outcome. That's where I get frustrated, because if Aaliyah isn't concussed, and we know Aaliyah is someone who's had an issue with concussion in the past, and that, just like Angus Brayshaw, you are more likely to. Now, I'm not a doctor, but that's clear. You can look that up, We know that that you're more likely to be concussed a second time, a third time, fourth time, if you have in the past. So if Alir gets up and walks off, or if it's any other player and has no issue, I don't think this is even being looked at all. And that's the biggest problem. There can't be this huge discrepancy, and it can't come down to luck as opposed to, you know, you're punishing someone on the action. As I said, if the action is what we don't want, then that's fine. I disagree with it. I think it's a fine tackle, but you got to punish everyone, not just the ones that go wrong. And that's, I think, the problem.
The outcome still matters because you can have a bad action with it, without the bad outcome necessarily. But I agree with you in terms of you need to be harsher on the action and not just suspend someone because of an outcome. The action still needs to be bad enough. I do understand that.
The frustrating part is, and I've used this example numerous times, and I'm going to use it again. And if this gets clipped up, I hope we can get these side by side. Let's get the Jack Higgins tackle, and let's get, from last year, Cozzie Pickett on Bailey Smith. And you get those two incidents side by side. And I barely would call the Higgins-Alir incident an incident anyway. But get those two clips side by side and show 100 people that don't watch football and say, which one of those actions is worse? And 100 people will tell you that Pickett's was way worse. Mm-hmm. Yet he gets 2 weeks and Higgins gets 3. And that just doesn't make any sense to me. It's incredibly frustrating. Yeah. And I can understand why they're taking it to the tribunal.
Well, the tribunal guidelines and table of offences still works as an outcome-based table, right? And so I think the AFL's setting Michael Christian up for failure here.
It's not his fault.
It had to be graded as 3 weeks. There couldn't have been anything else.
Based on the guidelines, he's only doing what he can do.
It's not his fault. It's just
the whole guidelines and the system, I think, is in desperate need of an overhaul. But the problem is Michael Christian's the face of it, and people say, oh, he doesn't know what he's doing. It's like, well, he's grading it correctly 95% of the time, but the outcomes and the sanctions and penalties, I just don't think makes sense based on that.
How does he get off?
How does he
get off?
I don't think he gets off. Weeks. I think it's just fewer weeks for... I don't think he...
But the reality is...
It surprised me with Charlie Cameron, but I can't see someone ever again going from 3 weeks to zero.
Alir was concussed. It has to be severe impact. I don't know how he gets it downgraded, but you can't give him 0 weeks because you've still sort of got to suspend that dumping motion, right? I know Alir tried to dispose of
it. I don't think it really was dumping him. I don't think it was as dumb.
He had an arm pinned and took him to ground. Alir probably contributed to that slightly by trying to kick the footy, that was inadvertent. He is allowed to do that.
He is allowed to do that, but the nature of dropping the ball down to your foot and you know you're going to fall. Like, that's just how it is. If you try and kick the ball as you're going down, you are going to snap. Your head's going to go down more. I mean. I think it is one of these incidents where they can't go... It feels like it should be 3 or 0. It feels like it can't be in the middle. And I think that's why it's not going to be... I can't see them saying, oh, yeah, 3's harsh, we'll make it 2.
I'm the opposite. And again, I'm sort of a stickler for the rules. If the, you know, the table of offences and what the MRO are looking at has everything you're ticking off on, and the final box is, was the player concussed or not? I'm completely fine with 1 week if he wasn't concussed, 3 weeks if he was. And I think I said to you before, sort of equated to someone gets into their car and they're drunk, they're drink driving. So, you know, drink drive, you're a bloody idiot, don't do it. But you jump in your car and you drink drive and you crash into a concrete barrier on the freeway, cops come along, you're going to lose your license for a year, you're going to get fined, you're going to feel the wrath, but you're not going to go to jail or anything like that because you've just hit a barrier you know, the results of your actions weren't as bad as if you hit somebody. You're going to get jail time and you're going to end up with a lot more world of hurt because the action that we're trying to stamp out is don't drink drive. But if your result gets worse, you know, if the outcome of what your incorrect action is of a higher value, you get punished more. And I'm sort of similar with that. We want to stamp out sling tackle. So it's one week if it ticks enough boxes. And then I'm happy for him to go to the medical report and say, okay, we're going to give you 1 week. Hey, Port, was Alir concussed or, you know, yes, he was. All right, we're taking it up to 3 weeks. I'm very comfortable with that, but I feel like everyone else is just...
I agree with that in the sense that drink driving in isolation, as you said, you're a bloody idiot, that's wrong. You're already doing something wrong. Whereas I don't think if...
But the AFL is telling us that sling tackles are wrong. So that's the other thing we've got to get ahead around. They weren't wrong 3 years ago, but the AFL want to tell us this action is wrong, then stamp out the action.
I think it's inconsistent because I believe this to be true, that if Alir is not concussed, I don't think anyone would be looking at that that tackle in isolation and saying that was wrong. He got lucky that Aaliyah wasn't concussed. That's where I disagree. I get that point is really good, but I just don't think people look at that tackle and think, oh, that was really bad. That was a sling tackle. He's got to be suspended for that regardless of... And that's why I think it's just so dependent on the outcome.
You end up,
it's gone too far the other direction.
You end up getting a situation where if players can't do that anymore, you get the Jake Collegiassini tackle on Matt Cottrell, where he's bear-hugging him on the weekend. He doesn't bring him to ground to risk a suspension or a concussion, but Cottrell goes... And Collegiassini is expecting the umpire to blow his whistle for ball up. Cottrell's standing there going, all right, I'm going to get my arms free and just kick a goal. So... Yeah. I mean, I don't know what the options are here, but I guess, I think it has to be a suspension.
We will have this discussion again.
There's just too much grey area to even know what's supposed to happen, but the guidelines that the MRO is working with, it's got to change, doesn't it? At least after this season.
And I think it will. I think it will change in some capacity, whether it's a full-blown rebuild of it, or whether they make tweaks. But I think the biggest issue right now is people just don't know. It feels too inconsistent, and I just don't think there's enough transparency with how it works, and that's a real problem.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night, ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end,
what will I become?
Senua Saga, Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Moving on, Christian, another interesting question came through on X over the weekend, just about the way the game is being played in 2024. I think we may have actually touched on this briefly a few weeks ago, just about the trends that we're seeing. But the question was, a lot of teams seem to be playing keepings off this year. Are there less stoppages this year than other years?
Yeah, not really. So there's fewer stoppages than last year, yes. But again, we've been around since 99. It is the, what are we up to, the sixth highest stoppages per game. So last year at 66.8 was the third most we've ever seen. So this is just ball up and throw in, when I quote the number. So taking out centre bounces. So actually stoppages around play. We've had 64 per game this year. The highest we ever got to was 2015. There was almost just under 71 per game. So again, the holding the ball and the dragging it in and sort of prior opportunity, they always tighten that when it gets a bit far out. Drop down in 2021, we dropped down to 59 per game, but it's slowly sort of come back up. 62 per game in 2022, 67 per game last year or just under, and 64 this year. So slightly less than last year, but not. I wouldn't say the game's completely opened up, but a few other stats I've looked at. I looked at kick-to-handball ratio. I thought that might have gone up a little bit. It was 1.51 in 2022, which was its highest it got to since 2005. So we sort of got back to 1.5 kicks for every handball, and we dropped down to 1.45 last year, back to 1.5 kicks for every handball. So back in 2015, again, when the stoppages were so high, it was 1.2 kicks for every handball. So it was a lot of handballing around stoppages, and that was the rolling balls to me. Mm. So at least the ball's being kicked and freed a little bit more. And marks, 83 marks per game is the most, equal second most we've seen across the season. Again, back in 2006, there was 99 marks taken per game. It just went through the roof for a couple of years. It's the equal fourth high. So there was 3 years around that time where we were above 90. 83 marks is three more sort of per team per game this year than last year. So a few signs there that slightly fewer stoppages. The ball, kicks and marks, you expect the ball to be flying more through the air and happening more. But you still got to go back 6-7 years ago. It was a completely different game.
Uncontested marks are the most we've seen in the last 10 years. Is that right?
Yeah.
And yet stoppages has sort of remained
remained the same. As I said, it went really out of hand 2014, 2015, so they changed the rules a little bit.
I'm guessing a lot of these uncontested marks are happening in the defensive half.
Again, I could have a look at it. Probably most of them, a little bit more in the attacking midfield as well. I think you're seeing a lot of teams chip it around 70 out rather than going for that final kick inside 50. I've noticed a little bit more
this
year. Is
that because after we have the 6-6-6, it becomes a case of when repeat inside 50s and teams just
And I think,
not park the bus, but they end up having 16 players inside defensive 50.
Yeah, and it'll be football theory and coach's theory. I think back in the day, it was just get it in there, get it to 30 out, get it to the hot spot, and good things will happen. Now, and we spoke about it on the pod plenty of times, now you can get it inside 50 too many times in a row and it just gets too flooded and you lose value from every entry.
So it's no like, space. Yeah.
Don't just get it straight in there, actually get it in there at the right time. Yeah. So it might be a little bit of change of philosophy. But when I look at the game, if I'm putting my fan hat on, I like to see more kicks and a lot more marks. I feel like that makes it a better game than the handball game, and that's sort of coming back up a little bit this year.
Another quick one before we move on, Christian. A couple of weeks ago, you took the guys through the 100X ratings to reveal underperforming players and the best players at that stage of the season. We thought it'd be fun. We're nearly a third of the way through the season,
which is
ridiculous to even say. Me and Jake wanted to put together our top five players of the season so far and just see how that compares to what you would say or what the numbers would say as to who's been the best five players of the season. So, Jake, give us your five first. We haven't seen these yet.
Yeah, there might be a few little surprises here, but I do believe this. So I'll start with five. Harry Mackay, not a player I would have ever expected to be on this list, and a player that couldn't get a spot in my top 50 going into the year. I thought he dropped off in the back half of last year. We all spoke about his improved goal kicking, but it's his contested marking. He leads the league in contested marks by an absolute mile. Never looks like dropping one. He's kicked 18 goals, which I think is fifth in the league, not that far off Kerno, who's back in the front. Number one rated forward in the league for score involvements, which I think is impressive. It shows how much he's getting involved.
Which is work rate. Yeah.
Incredible work rate. Number four, Zach Merritt. Spoken about him a heap. I think he's one of the most consistent, if not the most consistent, A-grade level player. Never plays a bad game. He's taken his game to another level since the captaincy and been very good this year. Obviously won the Anzac medal. Number three, Patrick Cripps. Numbers are back to when he won the Brownlow, really. It's quite scary how similar they are across the board. Dominating the midfield, kicking goals again. Kicked two against Cats and just an absolute bull. Caleb Sarong, number two. I think he has been extraordinary, and I just think he's flying under the radar massively. I mean, his numbers this year, just 32.5 disposals, 16 contested possessions, and almost 9 clearances a game. They're just unheard-of numbers. If he maintains that, he's going to feature prominently on Brownlow Medal Night. But the guy he's probably going to have to try and run down is Isaac Heaney, and I think we're all going to probably have him number one. He's just been unbelievable. And talking about players that I left off my 50 going into the year... I shared the list with half a dozen people, maybe more, maybe 10 people, and no one said anything about Heaney. So I wasn't alone in thinking it.
You sent me a list of guys that just missed out. Was he on that list?
I think he was. Yeah,
I love how you're trying to cast the blame on other people. Like, it wasn't me.
But yeah, he's been extraordinary. It's not just the ball he wins. It's his ball use. It's his goal kicking. It's his score involvement. It's clearance, contested ball, uncontested. He does everything. He is doing everything at an extremely high level. And yes, could easily be on 15, 16 plus Brownlow votes already.
No doubt he can. Really interesting top five because we actually have four of the same five.
Really?
Yeah, we do. And
that's
surprising. I don't need to spend too long on this because you've basically just said it all for me. So the four that we have... the same is Isaac Heaney, Caleb Sarong, Zach Merritt, and Harry Mackay. I had in there.
You had Mackay. No,
I was going to say.
I think he's having a big influence, best contested mark in the game. But I've put Elliot Yeo in there. I needed to give him some love as well. But Christian, what do the numbers say?
Yeah, so I've sort of gone to three different measures. So got raw rating points. So we talk about just how much influence you're having on a game. Rating points loosely can translate to how many points on the scoreboard you're worth for your team. So I think Heaney's at about 24 or so this year. So basically when he plays, he's worth 24 points to Sydney. So he's the number one rated player this year.
That's by a fair way, is that right?
So this is just match average. Matt Rowe second, Patrick Cripps third, Bontempelli fourth, and Sam Walsh is fifth in the rating. So that's just per game. Then we've sort of talked about the next sort of step to that is the 100X ratings where it looks at, obviously, those five names I mentioned, all inside centre-bounce midfielders, it gives you a lot more chance to win rating points.
Yep.
What 100X is, it actually looks at, if you're a key defender, what does a key defender usually get in 100 minutes in that position? And what was your score for the day? Were you plus or minus on your expected rating? So I was hoping this would throw out a few different sort of names and positions. But again, I think the best players are the best players. So 100X, Heaney, still number one. Matt Rowe, still number two. Yeo jumps up to third. So again, his rating points aren't as high as the five I mentioned, but his time in the midfield's a little bit lower than and then Cripps and Bont. So when he's in there, he's getting a lot more influence. Then you do have Bont in fourth and Patrick Cripps in fifth. So very similar names. As I said, Walsh drops out, Yeo comes up if you take out the minutes played. Then I also wanted to look at relative ratings as another good one. So this is actually looking at just how you're performing in your position for your age. So almost that schoolyard game of which player would you pick first? I'll be going to this list to say, okay, these guys are giving me value now, but they're also got, you know, the younger ones are either going to have their best years are still to come, or the guys that are sort of still performing in their prime are good to have as well. But the one that's on top of this one's a bit of a funny one. So Harry Sheezel is number one. It's because he's 89% rating points as a, I haven't got his age here, I think he's a 20 or 21-year-old general defender. But we know his position and sort of what we sort of said about North Melbourne, and probably the problem with North Melbourne is they've got to get this guy in the midfield. He's getting so much of the ball. He's not making the team any better by playing down there, I don't think. But he's just doing more than ever we've ever seen a general defender do. So he's number one in the comp for outperforming where he should be. Isaac Heaney, number two again. Nick Blakey down back, plus 81% for his age for a general defender.
So just going back to Heaney, what position do you have for Heaney?
So he's his midfield.
Yeah. And that's just midfield? This doesn't get broken down into mid-forward or anything
no,
like that?
No, so mid-forward is an actual position. That's when you're a 60-40 split between the two. So whether you're a 60% forward. So he's at 78%.
Because it's just this year.
Yeah. So he's at 78 or 80% midfield, I think, now. So he's not qualified for mid-forward. Nick Blakey third, Matt Rau fourth, and Nick Dacos comes in at plus 78%. So again, he's not up there for ratings and 100x because he's probably been moved around different positions. But we sort of know with Nick Dacos and the prediction that he'll probably be, probably a multiple Brownlow winner by the time he finishes. We sort of know he's going 78% better than he should be at that age. But pretty vanilla names, I would have thought, when we run through them. Not vanilla names, but there's no Harry Mackay or any surprises. It's the inside midfielders.
I think there's one name that we haven't mentioned across all of this, and it's Tom Green. Surprised he probably doesn't come up in a lot of those. Obviously, the age as well, what he's been able to do. Probably just missed mine, I think. Had a couple of down games, but certainly will be another player that features on Brownlow night and super, super important for the Giants, what they're doing.
Two guys I'll put up there, and again, my son's seven and daughter's 10, so they're getting into footy and learning things. I've said Harris Andrews and Sam Taylor for me. Almost if I'm picking a team, I would love a Harris Andrews. That's just for me of how safe they are when the ball goes down into that back line. You can always rely on them. Mm. They're never going to get, again, champion data. We 100x, we hope to get those guys closer to the top. They're never going to be a top five player.
So how does Sam Taylor win his rating points?
Sam Taylor, he's pretty good. Sam Taylor's his intercept position. He's the number one interceptor, so he does get a lot of them. So we talk about a lot of defenders sometimes. You've got to do a whole lot of nothing to be a good defender, whereas Harris Andrews and Sam Taylor, the reason they are such good key defenders is they go and get the ball as well. They don't just stop their opposition. But Sam Taylor, it's his one-on-one contested marking. So a contested intercept mark is sort of one of the best way to get rating points besides kicking a goal. So he's very good.
But if Sam Taylor's in a marking contest with Harry Mackay it's a 50-50, the ball kind of goes out of bounds. Does he get any?
No, he'll get a neutralised. So we have, in a one-on-one contest, you can win, you can lose, and you can neutralise. Yeah. You don't get any points for neutralising a contest.
Okay. Yeah. So, but a lot of people would see that as a win.
Yeah, which is why we record it. So we can come into, we can tell you how often you lost it and neutralise, but just in terms of physical rating points.
Well, we'll have to revisit this as maybe two-thirds of the way through.
See how the list changes. Good stuff. Really looking forward to this next chat, though. Pressure, one of the most important components of footy, and you'll hear this from every coach, whether it's like halftime break or in their press conferences. They always talk about, was there pressure there or not, as to how important it is.
Well, it's a fascinating topic because it fluctuates drastically.
So
forget
much.
Week to week, but from quarter to quarter, and it's obviously you can control a lot of things, but it's something that you always look at as effort. And I think we always look at effort should determine pressure.
Yep.
If you're on and you're putting in the effort, then there's going to be pressure. It's hard for 22 players or 18 on the ground to be giving 100% effort and your pressure to be quite low.
And I think that's, again, goes to why coaches can sort of bring that easier up in a press conference post-match, because it is something you can expect. It doesn't matter how skillful you are or how tall you are or how little you are. just please put pressure on. So it's that number you can see. It's just pure effort. It doesn't require skill.
It's sort of just thrown out there, or the pressure needs to be on. But we thought we'd take a deep look at this, because what exactly is pressure? And you see the pressure gauge and the meter on Fox Footy, and you see the big number over 200. But what exactly does that number mean?
Yeah.
So we wanted to ask you, Christian, you know, what is pressure? How is it measured? Who are the best players? Who are the best teams that apply pressure? And obviously how important it is as well.
Yeah, so pressure that we're recording, so whenever you see a pressure rating number is sort of what we turn it into, is just looking at how much pressure each disposal of a game was performed under, and then adds in all the tackles that sort of stop a disposal from happening. So tackling a player and causing a ball up is a pressure act, and will go into your pressure factor. And then every time someone kicks or handballs against you, how much pressure you were putting on them at that point of disposal. So bit of, you know, back and forth that we're always looking at is one big hole of the game we're not capturing is pressure on possession. So we know if you've got a hard ball get and a loose ball get, but we don't really know how much pressure you won the ball in compared to how much you disposed the ball in. Okay. And it is our next big thing to tick off the list is what players take from a pressure situation and get it out of a pressure situation, et cetera, et cetera. At the moment, we just know, all right, who, when they're disposing of the ball, who is under the most pressure and who is applying the pressure behind them. So that's where the pressure rating comes from, just point of disposal. And we have two capture staff that are sort of separate to everyone else that are just capturing all this themselves. And they basically
have things to do with pressure. They
also doing what foot each person's kicking with. So if it's a left or right foot, what their intended target of the kick is, if they were kicking to a leading target, a stationary one-on-one, a pack situation, if they're having a shot for goal. So they do a little bit more, but basically when they're calling the pressure act at each handball or kick, they quote a number. So it's either a physical pressure act, which they call, again, a bit of coder talk, they'll say three. So a three pressure act is physical.
Which is being tackled. Someone's got a hand on you and
affecting you. So one little finger on someone that's handballing the ball is not going to be physical pressure. It's going to be probably closing. You can feel the player that's receiving the physical pressure can feel it.
Yeah.
That is the top line of pressure. That's worth 375 points, if you like. It's written with a decimal, 3.75. So what that is when the player's under physical pressure, it's 3.75 times harder to hit the target than when you're under no pressure. And that's based on numbers that we collated
from the past.
So we first did pressure 2010.
Mm-hmm.
We did the whole of the 2010 season. With just these values, and we were able to work out the values from there. Okay, if it's a physical act, we need to make it this much. If it's a closing act, it's worth this much, etc., etc. So it was all set up in 2010. And as I said, if every single disposal the opposition has is under physical pressure, the pressure gauge that you'll see on Fox would say 375. But if you've ever paid notice to it, you never usually see that. It's usually set within a range of about 280, which is still very, very high, down to about 150. Because all the disposals get evened out. So as I said, physical pressure, 375 points. If you're closing in on a player as he's disposing it, so that's from the front or side and you're actually getting closer at the point of disposal, that's 225 pressure points. So a pressure rating of 225 means every single disposal is just under closing pressure and you're just getting hounded every time you
have
the ball.
But there's nothing in between those two.
There's nothing in between. So you could have three physical closing act and three physical acts and one closing act, and all we do is just average out that number across.
Yeah.
And that's your pressure rating for the game. So again, your pressure rating is basically just the average pressure each disposal is under for the opposition.
Yeah.
So chasing is the next one. So as I said, 375 physical, 225 closing, 150 for chasing. So 1.5 times harder to hit the target when someone's chasing you from behind and
how close would they have to be for it to be...
Again,
or how much further away would they have to be for it to be...
Two or three steps. So chasing. Either no pressure or chasing. So it's either there's a guy running behind him, but he can pick and choose when he disposes of the ball. Or there's a guy chasing him, so he knows I've got two more steps and now I have to kick it. So, it's sort of a little bit of subjective. So it's got to be the ball carrier knows that he's running out of time and needs to dispose of it.
This seems like, I'm sure it's all difficult, but this seems like an incredibly tough thing to do, looking at every single disposal
yep.
for a game and having to decide this every single time.
Yep, and again, so we've got the four physical closing, chasing, corralling was the last one. So there's only four options to choose from. We try, and I've said it a million times on this podcast, try to keep it black and white because we want everything consistent. Football isn't black and white, so it's a lot of... yeah, a lot of a video library and saying, okay, now that we're calling this closing, we're actually, you know, reconsidering changing it to chasing or something. You know, we haven't made many changes to this. We're all pretty consistent, but it does. You've got to watch probably three or four times someone else do the, do the role before you can sort of slot in and do your own game. So we try to keep everyone on the same page. But I think the hardest part of it is they're doing everything based on off the ball. So you're so ball centric and I'm a main caller, so I can call who gets the, I can call the possessions, I can call the disposals and the hit outs, et cetera, et cetera. The pressure is just like, who was that that flashed across the screen?
You just forget
it. Oh, their, their player ID is just enormous. They got to get player ID from just a little bit of tape or just a red boot appeared on the screen. So then they've got to go back and work out, all right, it was a red boot and there's three players wearing red boots. found him. There's Ainsworth. It's got to be like, just it comes down to, we've got the GPS stuff that we can really, if we really want to, we can go back to that and work out who's, but I think that's the hardest part of the job is the camera doesn't film the pressure player. It films the ball carrier and you've just got to work out the pressure player behind him. So, as I said, so the fourth level of pressure is corralling. So that's just sort of standing there in front of someone. You're not moving towards them as such, but you're sort of taking the space away. That's 120 pressure points. If you're under no pressure, you still get 100 points on your pressure rating. And for every set kick, you still get 75. So there'll never be a pressure rating of zero. If someone takes the ball, if someone gets a free kick in the ruck, chips it down the field, takes a mark, three marks in a row and kicks a goal, goes back to the centre, the opposition will have a pressure rating of 0.75.
Yep.
Basically just for being out there. Because, again, this got explained to me by a much smarter person. It made sense when they explained it to me, but there is no sort of zero. Like, they've started...
Right, so there's just no
one on the field. One is the starting value of no pressure.
Yeah.
It's actually easier to hit the target from a set kick than when you're
because
under...
Because it's all relative based on... Yeah.
No pressure means you're in general play, but there's no one around you, whereas a set kick is everyone has to stop and no one's allowed to sort of come near you. So that's the you know, the five acts that we're sort of doing, and from that we get to a number of, a total average. So...
So can I just jump in there? Because this you may have just answered a question I have. I always see pressure acts. So say Tom Liberatore had 32 pressure acts.
Yep.
Now, I think most people, when they think pressure, they think, oh, you know, he's had 8 tackles. Well, where have the other 24 pressure acts come from?
Yep.
So they're all corralling, chasing. That's a pressure act.
Yep, corralling, chasing, closing, and physical pressure are all pressure acts.
So it doesn't have to, it's obviously not just tackles. It's anything that... Yep. can contribute to this.
Yeah, every time they've been called by our pressure callers of chasing a kicker or corralling a kicker, that is a pressure act. So pressure acts is a nice number of how many times you're there putting pressure on, but then we also have your pressure points, which, again, it's sort of a funny name.
But you could have three or four pressure acts in a sequence of play if it's all in tight.
And if it's all corralling, you end up with 120 pressure points, which is very low. 200 is a good number to aim for. So three corralling acts where you're in the face of three handballs, but they're just handballing over your head.
Anything.
You get 120. You get three pressure acts, that's great. You get 120 pressure points, which isn't as great.
Yeah.
Whereas if you do the same thing, but you grab their arm each time they handball it, you might end up with three pressure acts and 375 pressure
points. How late can the contact be for it to be deemed physical pressure? Like
if someone's
handballing the footy and you just get there late and push him in the chest?
It'll be closing. Okay. So the physical pressure has to have... The balance doesn't come into it, but it's a good way to say it. It probably made him off balance, or at least you were grabbing his jumper. But there is some times where you look at it and go, and it's frame by frame now. It's like, that is two frames too late. It is closing. Like, you weren't actually touching him when he kicked it. So,
The other thing is there won't be any difference, or a player won't get any greater benefit or rating if they tackle someone and it's a stop and it's a ball up as opposed to tackling and it's a holding the ball free. Does that pressure... treated differently?
No, the pressure isn't. It's just that because you'll end up with a free kick, you'll get points for the free kick at your disposal. Yep. So you'll end up with more points because of the result.
But the
actual tackle, what you've done is the same. It's up to the umpire to call. If the umpire calls ball up,
that's true, yeah.
You shouldn't lose points because it's an umpire call.
Who are the best teams currently?
Yeah, so we look at pressure. And again, so the best teams, there's two ways to look at a best team in pressure. So who's applying the most pressure? Is always a good way to sort of look at it. So this year, who's applying the most pressure on their opposition? Carlton's number one. a lot of contests in their games and very much, you know, coming around to that stoppage-based game the last 4 weeks. Geelong number two, Gold Coast three, Collingwood four, and Port are fifth. So that's just applying pressure. If you look at, I just looked at last season, it was Sydney, Adelaide, GWS, Bulldogs, Fremantle.
Just totally
so
different.
None of the top five are the same across both years, just for total pressure.
Is it something that fluctuates a lot because they're all, the actual amounts are quite close?
I don't know. Sydney's always been up there. So it's surprised. Sydney would have been up there for 3 years in a row, aren't up in the top five this year. Adelaide come and go. Giants have been a big pressure team. Surprised to not see them in the top five. Mm. So it can be, but Geelong won the premiership and they rated 14th for pressure. This year, they're the top team going well. They're the third rated team for pressure. So for them, I reckon their switch has come. They're winning less contested ball and they know. We no longer, you know, before the weekend, they didn't have Cam Guthrie playing. Dangerfield's probably not the same. Joel Selwood's not there. Mm. They realise we don't have the raw contested ball winners, so we probably have to put a little bit more emphasis on the pressure. Of if they do beat us to the ball, we need to be ready to tackle them and corral them. So they're the second best pressure after, as I said, won the premiership being the 14th and neglecting pressure almost. So a little bit of a change for them. But if you look at best post-clearance pressure, so it's very easy. If the game's just continually at stoppages, it's very easy to put pressure on at a stoppage. You take one step and put your arm out and you're closing someone or physically because everyone's in closer. It's the post-clearance pressure. It's about the teams winning the ball in open space and you being able to close down on them quickly.
And that's what you would view as more important.
Yeah, well, yeah, and it leads to more, you know, a better win rate and things like that. So Carlton's the best post-clearance pressure team. Collingwood jump up to second.
Does that surprise you about Carlton's?
A little bit, yeah, because I see post-clearance pressure. I think you need a little bit of speed.
Speed, that's exactly
to
get
to it, and I don't see that when I watch Carlton. But the structure, again, I think they balance themselves out that they don't let the game open up. That was a big thing to when they played Brisbane in round zero. The more the game opened up and the more Brisbane were able to use the wings, Carlton just couldn't keep up with them.
Yeah.
But if it goes from contest to contest to contest, Carlton's always there, ready for the next contest. If they don't win the ball, they're ready to tackle you and get it to the next contest. It's on the spread. I think you can get Carlton with leg speed. So post-clearance, yeah, Carlton number one. Collingwood two, which is a big part of their game that they've always had. Port three, Sydney fourth, and Geelong fifth. So I think the best five post-clearance teams sort of stack up with a ladder better than the top five just raw clearance teams. I mean, Gold Coast drop out and Sydney come in. But then you can also look at pressure differential. So I've always stated that if you put high pressure on your opposition, you're probably going to receive high pressure as well because everyone's playing closer together and things like that. So Collingwood won a premiership based on their pressure differential. Surprising this year, I thought I'd run it and I'd get a good scope for a team. Port a plus 14 points for pressure. So talking about the pressure factor, if they're at 200, which would be very good, but if they're at 190 for every week, they're 14 more. So their opposition's usually at 176 each week.
And
that's the biggest. Sydney plus 9, Bulldogs plus 9, GWS plus 7, Carlton plus 3. So Port, fair way ahead. That's what Collingwood, again, that was one of the most impressive things for me of Collingwood the last 2 years, was their ability. They avoided pressure, but then they were able to put on pressure like immensely as well. So they always had the best differential.
Yet another important metric or area where the Bulldogs rate quite highly in.
Yeah.
We're talking about it 3 weeks in a row, I reckon, about just why are they not as good as they should be. But yeah, it is interesting that a lot of those teams are, because you say pressure, and as we started this segment, we were talking about it's effort-based, yet the good teams are the ones that rate high in it.
Yep.
It's not like you have poor teams that just, oh, we put effort on, but we're just not really good at anything else.
Yep. Just quickly as well, when it comes to players applying pressure, who are the best players in the competition, and does that correlate with the teams that they play for that you've just reeled off?
Yeah, so, I mean, some of Gold Coast and Sydney are higher. So the best pressure axe players, so Matty Rowell, 28.7 pressure axe per game. Row bottom 27.4 and Viney 27.4 pressure acts per game. Mm-hmm. But then you go to pressure points. So as I said, you end up with 3.75 for a physical pressure act and so on and so on. Row bottom has 72.7 pressure points per game. So he overtakes Rao. So his pressure is just a bit more of the closing and physical pressure than Matt Rao is. So Rao drops to second. Third is Will Graham. Up there with Matt Rowell, Parf at fourth and Libba fifth. But yeah, look at Graham and Rowell, sort of the academy sort of inclusion for Hardwick, it's almost like, well, just go play next to Rao. You know, we're sort of generating another Rao. I don't think he wins the ball as well as him, but his tackling's just been through the roof. And as I said, yeah, he appears second to Rao in a few numbers.
Rowbottom's an interesting one. I think Willem Drew, very similar type player, I think. Willem Drew is starting to get a little bit more love now, I think particularly after winning the medal a few days ago. But they feel very similar in terms of their role for their club and the importance. Yet everyone's going to continue to overlook them.
Yeah, I think Drew is a lot more. He's given license to win the ball at a few clearances. I think Robottom's just there to tackle almost, it feels like. So he's always sort of hanging on to a guy at the stoppage, and his main job is to not let them get easy ball out of the stoppage. So, as I said, Robottom, Rao, Graham, Parfitt, but they're all midfielders. They're all around the ball more. Yep. So we can also look at forward 50 pressure points and D50 pressure points. So I thought I'd give some love to the small forwards and backs. So Lockie Fogarty, when he was playing for Carlton, 21.1 forward 50 pressure points per game was number one. Paul Curtis, second for North, which is quite, you know, impressive considering how little North have the ball down there, but he is chasing quite hard. Sam Switkowski, who I don't know, I think me and you have discussed him. He is always in the top five for this stat, and it's where Champion Data sees Switkowski's value in the pressure and what he can do at ground level in the forward 50.
There was a bit of uproar when he was rated elite by you guys.
And I think a lot to do with was his ground ball winning and his tackling forward of centre was above everyone else. Charlie Cameron, fourth. And Darcy Byrne-Jones is fifth, who sort of switched down there the last 18 months. It's been a really good pressure forward for Port Adelaide. In the back 50, got Harry Sheasel up there again. So he's actually 17.3 pressure points in the defensive 50. Next most is Noah Answorth at Brisbane at 14.3. So it's a fair gap. But again, I feel like Sheasel's a midfield playing in the wrong zone. And this number almost says the same thing as well. He's got a lot more opportunity to put pressure on. The ball's down there a lot. But his numbers are so much similar to a midfielder.
But his numbers are skewed because we've spoken about this with Dustin Martin. The starting position and then the drifting.
Yeah, but he doesn't drift. That's the problem with him. He doesn't drift. He just plays defence, but they run the ball through him.
So much,
ball's down there so much. So he's getting a look at it like a midfielder. Just quickly wanted to go back to I was talking about post-clearance and pre-clearance. So it's much easier to put a pre-clearance pressure on. So if you're looking at your pressure number, sometimes it can be a bit misleading just to look at your pressure rating. You might want to look at just your post-clearance. Mm-hmm. So looking at win rates, so 2010 was the first year we did pressure. We did it at the end of the season off video, so coaches didn't get it live. And 2011 was the first time we went live in a coach's box and they could actually make decisions based on that. So when we did it off video, the win percentage for pre-clearance pressure, you win more pressure pre-clearance and you win 52% of the time, 66% for post-clearance pressure. And it's almost, as I said, as it's got live into the coach's box, it's almost gone up nearly every single year, fluctuated, but we're up to this year, 55% of the time you win pre-clearance, you win the game. 74% post-clearance, you win the game.
Well,
so that's applying more pressure. So,
and you just expect that to keep trending upward?
I would think so. So again, the second part of it is, yes, pressure's a great number, but really take away the post-clearance pressure number is the effort and the structure that the coaches are probably talking about post-match.
So post-clearance pressure is the one that you really need to try and be strong at.
Yeah,
that's the one that you win games.
The most important place to put pressure.
74%. It's higher than I thought it would be, but there you go, Jake. Pressure. Interesting stuff. Almost time to wrap things up, gents. But before we do, we've got to get into justified hype or hyperbole. Three really big statements we've got to get to here. Ooh. And Jake was absolutely begging for this one to be in here. So I cannot wait to ask you this one. You know, because you put it in the run sheet. It is time to scrap the draw and have extra time for home and away matches.
I do remember asking about this. I have never...
Don't say it.
I've never once had an issue with the draw, ever. I've been at games that have ended in a draw involving my own team. I've watched dozens more on TV, and I think I asked you how many there have been since 2000, 41 draws. It's never bothered me a game ending in a draw. I don't know why, for the first time watching Anzac Day last week, I thought, why are we stopping? And that, I don't know why it occurred to me then for the first time. And since then, I've been thinking about it. Why was I never bothered by it in the past? I should have been. We shouldn't be stopping when at the
why?
End.
Why? Why? What for?
Draws are exciting. It does nothing for anybody. No, it's not exciting.
Of course it's exciting.
No.
Both teams were out there trying to win the game of footy because the scores were locked up. What are you saying? What are you saying is better, going to extra time and playing more?
Of course,
more
that would be exciting. All right, knowing
so 1 minute to
wins.
Go, the scores are all locked.
Yeah,
we're going to extra time anyway. We'll just ship it around, get to extra time. The draw brings even more excitement to the finish of a game.
No, I totally disagree, because you guarantee that you're going to have the pinnacle of excitement, which is a team scoring a winning score.
You don't need a result.
No, I'm not a result. Jared, if you know there's a time period coming up, okay, it's like in 1 minute time, we're going to have to play another 10 minutes. There's going to be so much management of the clock in that last. You're going to take away a lot of the desperation at the end of the game, because people go,
the thrill is
we
no
know
more.
We've got another 10 minutes.
You can't just defend forever. You're going to need to.
No, but for that last minute, again, bad example of the weekend, because we spoke about Nick Hyde not showing any urgency in that last 20
seconds.
Oh,
yeah, he did the same thing.
But what we're saying is the urgency gets taken out of a game. Yeah, I'm with Jared. That last minute or two, the urgency gets taken. It's like, do we really need to try to score? Because the harder we try to score, the more likely they are to score.
Yeah.
So let's just all shut the game down. And it almost becomes like a gentleman's agreement. We're getting close to extra time.
It becomes
see this
survival
last
of the fittest in the end. If you had an extra 2 days break, you're way more favoured in the extra time than the other team.
An extra 2 days break?
Just say hypothetically.
You wouldn't have 2 days break. You would...
Hypothetically, if you're coming off a 5 day break, the other team's coming off a 7, and you go.
You're playing for another minute or two.
No,
adrenaline's flying.
So is it 2 points minute is enough? So is it golden? So
it's,
you're looking
it's
for
next
golden
score wins.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
so...
And I thought about this. It shouldn't be next goal. I think it's next score win. The minute that the scores aren't tied anymore, the game's over.
Mm.
And I think that would create enormous amount of excitement from the fans. The other thing is, Scott Pendlebury was asked afterwards, he said we should keep going, Zach Merritt said we should keep going, and I would be stunned if there was a single player that plays right now that wouldn't want to keep going and play for the win. I don't think any player is happy to have a draw, ever.
I think you play four quarters of footy, you're either good enough to win or you're not. You walk away with 2 points, it is what it is.
It just does
the extra
nothing
time
for anybody.
Finals, I'm
it does
fine
nothing
with
for anybody. The excitement you would get from playing, continuing to play, we do it in finals now, keep playing for a win-loss result. I think it makes so much more sense than ending in a draw. I know it's a quirk of the game, but so is bouncing the ball out of centre bounce, and that will eventually be gone too.
Plays too much hectic with shift time, so no thank you.
You guys make out like it's going to keep going for 45 minutes or something. One for you, Mr. Barker. Richmond would be better off parting ways with Dustin Martin, Liam Baker and Dan Rioli.
Yeah, justified. I think they will certainly be better off. They just need to bite the bullet. They're stuck in a really weird position now, sort of trying to squeeze as much out of the lemon as possible.
Bottom out and go again.
Bottom out, go again. I mean, probably thought they could make finals this year at their absolute best. They're clearly not going to do that. They're not playing finals next year either. You got Tassie coming in a few years' time. I think they've got to stay ahead of the eight ball. You know, players such as Liam Baker and maybe Daniel Rioli, if the rumours are true, there's going to be value there in the way of draft picks and getting more young talent in the club before Tassie come in with their concessions. They're just stuck in a really weird place. And I think they need to stay ahead of this. And yeah, I think they'll be better off without those three players and maybe even more players.
Well,
better off in the long term, if they can
get value. I mean,
they're not
going to
win as
Dustin
many games.
Martin. Dustin Martin will not be playing footy for Richmond next year. I don't think he'll be playing footy at all. I think he's.
I agree with that.
So they're not getting anything for him.
But there's no point doing what they're doing right now, cashing in
on those guys.
Absolutely.
But then you go back and say,
should they have gone
and got Tim Taranto and Jacob Hopper? I think I raised this a month ago about is Tom Lynch someone that they should be considering moving on from? And the problem with Lynch, as we spoke about a couple of weeks ago on Red Time with Matt, was his contract, back-ended contract. He's going to be making upwards of $1.4 million next year. I think it's the final year of his contract. But there would be clubs interested, but you're going to have to pay half of that. It's dead money.
If you have to meet the club's demands because he's on site,
it's too hard for it to work. But that's the nature of backloading it.
Yeah.
So you can pay all these guys when you're paying Trent Cotchin and Jack Riewoldt and Dusty and everyone else. So I tend to agree. I think Liam Baker is the one. I think he has shown he
he's worth a bit.
Yeah, for sure.
Yep. I think they They need a cull. Otherwise, they'll just be winning seven or eight games per season for the next 2 years until Tassie come in, and then they're going to be worse off. So, yeah.
Yeah, and that's a good point. You want to get those picks coming in now before the compromised draft with Tassie.
I say they're in a weird position and a bad position. It's almost a good position to...
You'd rather be now than in 2 or 3 years.
To be where they
time.
Are now than in 2 or 3 years' time. Yeah. So they do need to cull. Last one, Christian, is for you. If Gold Coast beat Brisbane... this week, they are officially the number one team in Queensland.
I think it's hyperbole. Like, one game? I don't know. Like, I don't think this one Q clash, it'll
But about
it'll
the whole season and everything we know about these two teams right
Gold
now.
Gold Coast already are higher. Like, that's what I'm saying. What's this officially word that you've thrown in there? Gold Coast are higher on the ladder at the moment.
So you already think they are?
This year, they're going better than Brisbane. I don't know why. And again, this is probably more of a... sort of a cheeky drive-by to the media. What's this big statement of now they're officially the number one team? It's like there's two teams in Queensland, one higher on the ladder.
Guy, aren't you?
Well, Suns are better than Lions at the moment, so they already are the number one team. But I don't know what makes them the official number one team. So, but yes, I think they're already overtaken them as this year they're going better than Brisbane. So
interesting game. That's all we have time for today's episode, Christian. Thank you for joining us, Jake. I'll speak to you on Red Time on Thursday, which we always
look forward to. That
look forward to, guys. Thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you on the next episode.
Thanks for joining us on the ESPN Footy Pod. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.